Otherwise, though, it's been fine, except for yesterday. I went to Waffle House to eat, and I'm still learning how to eat with braces because I just got these put on 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And I bit into my Texas bacon, egg, and cheese melt like I normally would. And it felt like somebody stabbed me in the mouth.
Oh, that is terrible.
So I had to, and I mean, the bacon was getting stuck everywhere in my braces and it was just not pretty. So it's like, I had to eat the rest of the sandwich with a fork and a knife.
Oh, you poor thing.
Like some posh jerk sitting in a Waffle House eating a Texas bacon, egg, and cheese melt with a fork and a knife. Like, so I was that jerk.
Like, I'm fancy, but not so fancy where I can't go to a Waffle House.
I'm Waffle House classy.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi, listeners. We're back with another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids. Tessa is back on hiatus for, you know, hopefully until just the end of this year. But we've got another guest this week. This is my friend David. David and I were stationed together in Northern California for quite a few years, and now he is stationed in Korea. So this is another early morning for Sammy. And then late night for David.
Yes.
So David, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and about like your YouTube channel and everything. So,
okay. Yeah. So, like Sammy said, my name is David. I am currently living in Seoul, downtown Seoul, which is wonderful. I have a beautiful wife and two kids, been married for almost 8 years now. So that's awesome. And let's see, a little bit about myself. I do a whole lot of nothing. I
kind of feel like everybody does a whole lot of nothing right now with quarantine.
It's like, well, tell me about yourself. Well, I sit around and watch a whole lot of Netflix. let's see. Like Sammy said, I have a YouTube channel that my wife does most of the work for. But it's just kind of like a family vlog. We just kind of document what we're doing here in Korea, and we just have a lot of fun doing it. It's called Team Row. So nice. if you just youtube.com/Team Row, go.
And that's Rowe, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Rowe. So, or if you just like in the search bar type in Team Row, our logo is a globe with a paper airplane flying around it. So
dope.
Yeah. So check us out if you are feeling like you want to check us out.
Yeah, you definitely should. They've got a lot of neat stuff. It's neat to just see, you know, like how different parts of the world, how they live their lives day to day, because especially as coming from somebody who's really never been outside of the country other than living in England until I was four, it's you get into this like habit and this mindset of thinking that everybody lives just like you. Every other country is very similar to yours. And it's like, it's neat to kind of break outside of that mental headspace and see just how other people around the world live and how different it can be, but then also how similar it can be in some aspects as well. So,
yeah, I would say like one of the most shocking things that has happened to us since we've lived here was it was actually our first Sunday trying to go to a church that we found here, and we got lost. And, you know, at the time, this was 7 months ago now, we didn't speak any Korean. And this random Korean lady just came up to us right when we got off the subway, and we like were able to barely communicate that we were lost. And she took us to lunch and like fed our kids and was like taking care of them so Stephanie and I could enjoy ourselves. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, in America, if you are a foreigner and you do not speak English, how often would you see someone go out of their way to try to help you?
Oh, never.
Exactly. I think that was like the craziest thing, because it was like that that was kind of like the wake up call, like, wow, this is how different the culture is here.
Yeah. But that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish we were more like that here in America. I mean, these days you don't even help somebody out if they do speak your language.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like for somebody to go out of their way and, you know, bridge that language barrier and just be like, you know, I know that we barely understand each other, but I'm going to take you and your family out to lunch and just make sure that you're okay and safe. That's just, we need more of that in just our world in general. So it's nice to see that some countries have a good head on their shoulders.
Yeah, it's been wonderful living here. And I would highly suggest anyone to come visit if you can, because there's, I mean, any season, no matter what, there's always something to do here. So,
right. Well, I'm going to try. I really am. Like, yes, that's on my bucket list. So,
yes, well, we have a room for you. So
nice. Well, hopefully I will get to use it maybe once quarantine lets up. So
yes.
All right. Well, let's jump into this. We're going to shake our penny for our thoughts. And for those of you who are just tuning in for the first time and don't know what that means, we shake a penny in a shot glass to decide who gets to go first. So I'm letting my guest pick whether he wants heads or tails, but my luck dictates that I'm always going to go first anyway. I don't know why, but I almost always win the coin toss. I would say at this point it's about like a 90% ratio of me winning. Don't know why. So go ahead and pick. Would you want heads or tails?
I'm gonna go with tails.
Tails. All right, let's see what we got. Oh, it's tails. You get to go first.
What?
That never happened. Okay.
Well, in the cases of probability, your chances just went down, so.
Well, there you go. So you've got a cryptid for us. Actually, you've got two cryptids for us, right?
Yes. So
okay.
It was actually really difficult to pick one. Actually, it was really difficult to pick any at first because to find good information, it was all in Korean. So I had to try to translate and ask friends for help. But once we got past that, I picked two because it was really hard to just settle on one because Korea has some really cool cryptids. So the first one that I want to talk about is like a legendary cryptid. It's like,
okay,
it's as old as Korean history itself.
Ooh.
It's like in every children's folklore that you can imagine.
Okay.
But it's the Korean goblin, and in Korean it's dokkaebi. And
okay.
If you've seen, there's actually a K-drama called in English I think they call it Guardian,
okay,
but it's also translated to goblin depending on which streaming service you use.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so that's actually about, it's like a modern retelling of the historical dokkaebi.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because you know, like Western goblins are kind of seen as like ugly and all their like really evil things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the like Eastern goblin, Korean dokkaebi, are they're sometimes seen as beautiful. They are often depicted wearing like hanbok, and hanbok is like the traditional like Korean garb.
Okay.
So if you've seen any like historical K dramas, you'll see they have like these nice robes and like the really wide brimmed hats.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these goblin, they also have like supernatural powers that they use to like interact with humans. And what I really like about these goblins is that they're prone to like playing tricks on humans. Some of them are depicted as like repaying humans for their evil deeds and things like mm-hmm. that. But some of them also help humans.
Okay.
So it's like, it's this weird balance, which is why the K-drama, it's called Guardian, because it's actually about two dokkaebi. One of them is a guardian and one's a goblin, like that sort
of. They sound almost like Western folklore's version of fairies, you know,
because
like the fae or the fairies in Western folklore, you know, they're traditionally seen as beautiful, not ugly, like our version of goblins. And they're magical, and some of them are tricksters and some of them are guardians. So it definitely sounds very similar to a Western fairy, not so much a Western goblin.
Yes. Yeah. Very much so.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So also one of the reasons that I picked goblins was because of like the deep history of it. So the earliest documentation of a Dokebi is from the Shilla era. So Shilla is one of the dynasties of Korea, and it was from 57 BC to 935 AD.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So there's this, book called the Memorabilia of the Three Kingdoms, which goes over the, Goguryeo, Bakje, and Shilla dynasties. And there's a story in there called Lady Dowa and Bachelor Bihyun. And in that story, they're talking about Dokebi. And it's crazy to me to think that there's stories of goblins at, you know, written at the same time as parts of the Bible were being written, you know, like,
I've talked about it on this show before, just how difficult it is for especially Americans to comprehend anything beyond like 1776, you know, because it's like our country is so young.
Yes.
You know, like it's barely 200, almost like what, almost 300 years old. It's a very young country, you know, so it's like we can kind of picture back to like, you know, the 1600s, if you're thinking like Salem witch trials and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, for the most part, anything past like the 1600s, we can't really comprehend. So to think about these countries that they have written history that dates back to like before Christ, you know, BC, it's like, it just blows our minds, and it's so difficult for us to wrap our minds around it because we're used to such a young country with like no history.
So it's really funny that you say that because there's a Korean War Memorial / museum like right down the road from our apartment. And it's like three stories tall. And I remember when I was a kid and we would go to like museums in America, it was always so boring to me because it was always like, you know, the same, like Civil War, and then you've got World War One, World War Two, like the same, like
the same, like five wars over and over and over. Yeah.
So we went here and we spent, I want to say like close to 8 hours, and didn't get to see half of it because,
oh my God,
because Korean history is so old that like they have documentation of wars from, you know, BC, and it's like, it's crazy. Like correspondence letters for troop movement and stuff like that. And
right.
I mean, it's insane.
It's really fascinating. It really is. Like, I love history. It's one of my favorite subjects. And most of the time when I start talking about any topics, I usually pick historical ones, and I just, it'll be like, hey, this is the cryptid I'm going to talk about, but here's 20 minutes of me just talking about history, and then, and there's a cryptid and I'm done. So I get this.
Yeah. I feel like that's kind of what this is going to be. I'm hoping that it's interesting at least, because it was very interesting to me to do some of this research. But I mean, like when you're talking about something that, that has such a history, like the history does play such an important role in the
character. You don't want to leave things out, you know, you don't want to like leave out important information. So I get that.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dokebi are, like I said, they're portrayed as being tricksters and sometimes also being helpful. It really depends on the writer who's speaking about them.
Okay.
There are like 8 different types of Dokebi, and I thought this was really cool. So I'm not going to name them all because it would literally be like a good couple minutes of me like trying to pronounce them all correctly. but you have like, there's like a mischievous type. It's kind of like different types of Pokemon. So you got like mischievous type. You have an evil type. There's a dumb type that looks like that they're depicted as looking like farmers.
Okay.
There, yeah, there's a daytime traveler. So they're, those are the ones that are kind of seen as like more beautiful because they're more presentable to society. Okay. Then there's a type that is good at using weapons and fighting in general. Okay. And there's another kind that's very attractive, and they're known for, they're specifically male and female, and they are known for attracting humans, whether it's to like play tricks on them or lead them to their demise or to help them in some way.
Okay.
And then these last two are my favorites. There's it's specifically one-eyed, and it enjoys eating a lot. Okay. And then the last one is one-legged, and it is undefeated in Korean wrestling. So Korean wrestling, kind of to go off on a rabbit trail, because I thought this was really interesting too. Mm-hmm. Korean wrestling is similar to sumo wrestling. The wrestlers will wear like a belt, and then it has a strap that goes around their thigh.
Okay.
And so this one-legged dokebi is undefeated unless you can exploit its right side, because apparently its right side is the side that's always missing the leg.
Okay.
And usually they're in tales of like, they're kind of like the troll under the bridge, or like the Black Knight. Like you can't cross bridges without wrestling them, or there's some, like they're like a gateway keeper or passage keeper.
Right.
So those are the stories kind of around that type of dokebi.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did try to find some like recent tales of them. But it's kind of hard because they are so ingrained in like the like Korean culture and history. So it's like all of their tales are kind of more like folklore and stuff. Like you don't really have anything like people talking about like, oh, I saw
one on my way to the supermarket.
Yeah, or like someone was playing a trick on me right now.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So, but they also have like a couple other things attributed to them. So they have something called a dokebi kamdu, which is their hat that they wear, and it grants the wearer invisibility. So there are stories about how like if you can capture one and you can take its hat, then like you can become invisible. And so there are stories. Yeah, there are stories, like lessons learned about how like, if you do that, be careful because you never know what kind of trouble you're going to get into. And then they also have a magical club that they use for like summoning things. It's essentially a wand, but it's
okay.
A club that they also fight
with. So like a magic like club for beating things, not a magic club like dance club.
Yeah, like summoning all the homies.
A dokebi dance club.
Yeah, we just play this music and it summons the things we want. There's actually one story that I found that I thought was really interesting. And I don't know, do I have time to tell it?
Yeah, take your time.
It's a pretty short story, but so there was an old man who lived in the mountains kind of by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And one day a dokebi came and visited him, and the man was very surprised by this. So he ended up offering the dokebi drinks, and they ended up talking, and they kind of became friends. And so fairly often the dokebi would come and visit, and months have gone by, and this old man was walking down by the river, and he looked in the water and he saw that he was turning into the dokebi. He started to resemble it. And so he started to get really mm-hmm. scared, and he didn't want to hang out with this dokebi anymore. So he devised this plan. And the next day that the dokebi came to visit, he asked him, he said, you know, what is your greatest fear? And the dokebi mm-hmm. said, blood. What's your greatest fear? And the old man said, money. That's why I live out here by myself. I fear money.
Hmm.
So the dokebi left, they had their drinks, and he left. And the next day the man went out and slaughtered a cow, and he covered his house in blood. So the dokebi came and was terrified of all the blood. And he said, mark my words, I'm going to come back and make you pay for this. And the next day the dokebi came and threw piles of cash on him, and he became the richest man in the town.
Oh, I love that. So he tricked him.
Yeah. So, which kind of leads me to how Tokebi are created, or how they're spoken of being created. So, you know, in this story, it talks about like hanging out with one too often can turn you into it. But most of the things that I read said that they actually usually come from inanimate objects being possessed. So usually it was saying like old broomsticks that have just like been thrown out. They'll become possessed by this spirit and it becomes a Tokebi. Or it also specifically said things covered with old human blood.
So they're haunted.
Pretty much.
So haunted or possessed items. Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. But like I said, they're kind of used as like fairy tale things, kind of to, you know, teach your kids lessons.
Cautionary tales for children.
Yeah, pretty
like
much.
The boogeyman, you know, things like that. Gotcha.
Hansel and Gretel.
Yes. Yeah. The witch in the woods. Yeah. I totally get it. Okay.
Yeah. So, which leads me to the second cryptid that I chose. Now this one is, I tried to choose like something that was like historical and legendary, and then one that's more modern, and has a few more, I guess like modern tales about it. This one's pretty recent, actually. It's called the Jungsan Tiger. So in Korean, San means mountain. So Jungsan is a mountain range. And this tiger was actually first spotted in 2010.
So that's recent.
Yeah, pretty recent. It's so I want to talk about the description, because this is kind of the funny part to me. So it's got long white hair. It has short back legs, kind of described as like a hyena's legs. And then its front legs are like an overgrown sloth, like the arms of an overgrown sloth.
And it's
described as having like a three-toed sloth. Like it's got three huge claws and it's got these long lanky arms.
Sounds very unproportionate and kind of creepy looking.
Yeah. It like, you can't really imagine it moving like at all. I don't know how it moves, but it's like, it said that like the back legs, the reason they're shorter is they're like stocky and real meaty, and, they're really powerful. So it's able to like leap and bound and like pounce on its victims. And then its long arms are unlike a sloth in the sense of it can actually move quickly and it has them for climbing. So it's like, this is like an all terrain animal. It's like the mountains that it's described as, or the mountains that it's been found in, are like, it's got very steep rocky parts. It's got like forests. It's got, like kind of, like plateaus and stuff. So it's kind of, it's told, or it's said that it can like traverse all of them very quickly.
Just having like long arms like that and short back legs, it allows you to really gallop well. That makes sense.
And then its face, it has like a flat humanish face. Like, it doesn't have like a snout, but it has, upper and lower fangs, like a saber-toothed tiger, essentially.
I'm picturing one of those like cats that looks like they've been hit in the face with a frying pan.
Yes. With like long white fur.
Yeah, but with big fangs sticking out.
Yes.
One of those like pug cats, you know, they look like a pug, but they're a cat.
Yes. Except the terrifying part is that it's described as being slightly larger than a fully grown man.
Okay.
So, I mean, you're looking at like a full-size tiger with these long, creepy arms. And
long white fur,
powerful hyena type legs,
saber tooth jaws, sloth claws. This is terrifying. Like
it is. It's like something.
Just
out of
imagining it. Okay, I just looked up a picture of it. That is absolutely horrific, and I hate everything about that.
Can you like it reminds me of like when you're in a dream and you're trying to run as fast as you can, and no matter how hard you run, you're like running through mud. Like I feel like that's what it would be like if this thing was chasing you.
Yes, that is definitely a nightmare creature for sure. 100%.
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about it is that most mountains in Korea are actually like national parks. Mm-hmm. And so there are theories behind why they're parks and some of the rules behind these parks. So you're not allowed to enter parks at certain hours. I think most parks open at like 4 a.m. and they close at like at dusk.
Okay.
And this, the Jungsan tiger has been spotted only in the hours of night. Like it's a nocturnal creature. So it hunts at night.
Okay.
So people kind of, theorize that the reason that the parks are closed is to try to like keep the public safety.
I mean, can you imagine like you're just taking your dog for a stroll in the park at night or you're taking your kids, you know, in their stroller, you know, through the park at night to kind of calm them down before bed. And this white sloth looking nightmare creature just comes galloping up towards you. I would probably pee my pants.
Yeah.
And then second of all, like I would be out of there so fast that I would probably forget my dog and or children.
Yeah. I mean, flight or flight is real.
Yeah. Like if you see a pair of pants flying through the air, don't grab them because I'll be in them.
Or you won't be. And they're flying because they're soiled.
Yeah, that too. Ugh, absolutely horrific. And I hate everything about that. Like, I imagine that this thing has glowing red eyes because a lot of these cryptids, it doesn't seem to matter what country they're from. Glowing red eyes just seems to be a staple. So this seems like a glowing red eye kind of cryptid.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And so it actually has like a couple origin stories. And I have a favorite.
Okay.
I'll tell two of them, the two most popular ones.
Go ahead.
So the first is that there's a traditional Korean play about this this white lion that defeats evil spirits, and so people believe that this is like an incarnation of that. It's a spirit, like a white lion spirit. So people think it's like an incarnation of that. And so I won't go into too much detail about like the play itself or anything like that. But the other most popular origin story is that it is a real animal and that it was hunted pretty much to the brink of extinction during the Japanese occupation of Korea. So it's kind of hunted for game, for sport, things like that. And I think that's my favorite origin story.
I like that
because, I love mystery. And, I mean, Sammy, you obviously know me, but, for everyone who doesn't know me, like the ocean is the most mysterious thing to me. And I mean, that's why every tattoo I have is ocean related essentially. To think, you know, we know what 5 to 10% of our ocean.
It's terrifying. It really is. Like it's absolutely kind of terrifying.
Yeah. So I think like to kind of translate that to like our above ground terrains, you know, I can't imagine that we have discovered 100% of our above ground earth. I mean, there has to be mountains and caves and sinkholes that we don't know about.
No, there's no way we've discovered 100% of our terrain. There's just no way, you know, no. Like, yeah, maybe we've mapped it as far as like, hey, you know, this is an area, you know, and it's like, yeah, we've got satellite images of everything, but there's no way we've explored every nook and cranny that our planet, yeah, has to offer. There's just no, yeah, way.
And I mean, if you think about like over our history, like human history, mm-hmm, there, out of the entire world population, there's only a handful of adventurers that are out there for the sake of discovery.
Right.
You know, through each generation. So I'm sure that, you know, if everyone came together and everyone started to explore, then yeah, we might have a chance of starting to discover everything.
Right.
But I mean, there's gotta be parts of mountains that no one's been to, because I mean, for the most part, like the human population is where it is today because, you know, humans really only do things for specific reasons. And yes, usually it's
monetary gain.
Yeah. Capital gain. So it's, yeah, like, and I mean, that's how like our modern world has been built, and it's great. It's, yeah, worked great for us. But that being said, if there's no reason to go climb that mountain and discover every single cave that's in it, it probably hasn't been done.
Yeah.
You know, or yeah, if it has, that's
very true.
I mean, think about this too. Let's say, you know, someone like you or I or one of the listeners decides, hey, you know what? I will go on these adventures and I will go, mm-hmm, see these things. You're underfunded. You are really just going, yeah, out on your own. So what if you do discover something like the Jiangsan Tiger and now you're dead?
Yeah.
So it's like maybe things have been discovered that we just don't know about because it hasn't been documented, hasn't been reported on, things like that.
It's possible. It's definitely, yeah, possible.
Yeah.
So
I mean – And then to think that, you know, we do have intelligent animals, you know, mm-hmm, we have like dolphins, monkeys, you have animals that, I mean, even just for the sake of survival, think of what animals are willing to do to survive, yeah, you know, so think of if there was something out there, if there was the Jiangsan Tiger and it, mm-hmm, was hunted to the brink of extinction. Maybe it has adapted to that and is now like, hey, you know what? Like, I'm not trying to go extinct.
Yeah.
Like, I need to preserve myself. So I'm going to hide in this mountain.
Yeah.
So
it's possible. It's definitely very possible. So no, like the thing about cryptids is like, there is still so much that's unknown about where we live. You know, it's just,
yeah,
you know, and we haven't, like, every year new species are discovered and, you know, new plants are discovered, new bugs are discovered. So it's like,
yeah,
and that's still going on in the year 2020. That's still going on. We're still discovering, you know, hundreds of new species every year. So it's like, yeah, in any one of those species that we discover could have been a cryptid at one point in time.
For sure. You
know, so the possibility of cryptids is out there because there are still creatures that we don't know about and we're discovering every year. So it's like,
yeah,
it's only a matter of time before we do eventually discover these cryptid species and they become something that's a documented and cataloged species that we have like a genus name for and everything that previously was just a creature of legend. So
yeah. It also reminds me of like, I've been seeing like Instagram posts of like the skull of a creature. And then it's like under that, it'll be like, what science will tell you that it looks like. And then it's like, mm-hmm, this like weird, like ghastly alien looking thing. And then it's like, mm-hmm, what the creature actually was. And it's a hippo, you know? It's,
yeah,
like, so it's,
well,
like,
that's the thing is like, you know, a lot of times just going off of fossil evidence and stuff like that, we don't know specifically what they looked like. Like, you know,
yeah,
a lot of dinosaurs, like the idea of what they look like, might very possibly be completely inaccurate. They might have had a, yeah, lot of body fat. You know, like we always, yeah, see them as these very thin, almost skeletal creatures with like skin pulled tight over them. In fact, I think some scientists refer to it as like cellophane dinosaurs, you know, because it just looks like, yeah, you know, cellophane stretched over a skeleton, where it's like they may have had significant body fat. They may have had feathers. You know, they may have looked drastically different from what, yeah, we see them as. I mean, you see like, any bird that's been like plucked of feathers and they kind of look dinosaur-esque,
yeah,
you know? So it's like, we don't know what they look like. We're just kind of judging off of fossil evidence. So even that could tie into cryptids and how we view them. And, you know, there's so many possibilities out there for what a cryptid is and whether they're real or not. You know, yeah, I don't ever really deny the possibility unless the origin of it can be traced back to a specific point in time. Like, for example, the jackalope, that can be traced back to like the 1800s in like the Midwestern United States. They literally created it for the sake of being like a tourist item that could be bought. So it's like that can be literally traced to a certain date and point in time and a certain person that created it, you know. But it's, so it's like those ones, obviously, they're interesting and it's neat that they've got their own lore and everything, but it's very clear that they're not real. But then you've got things like the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot, where it's like there really is no point in time, you know, where that just kind of popped up out of nowhere and somebody claims to have invented it. It's like these legends have been around for centuries, you know, and it's like, legends don't pop up out of nowhere without some basis in reality.
So, I mean, unless, like you said, unless someone is doing it for the sake of having
monetary gain.
I mean, that just goes back to that. So, So, I wish I could just keep going about the cryptids. There are some really cool Korean cryptids. Like, just as an example, there's Guishin is like ghost. So they have like a Mul Guishin, which is like a water ghost. That is, they are like attributed to like drownings and things like that. So we have like the Han River right here. So like, they will like pull people down, and drown them. So they're not lonely, essentially. And then you have like, so this one's actually kind of interesting. If you come to Korea, you will see that there are places that have like, monuments of like very phallic displays all over the place. There are like whole museums dedicated to it. And at first, whenever Stephanie's my wife, for the listeners that don't know me, when we first saw these things, we're like, what the heck? Like, why is this here? Like, why are
why is there a giant penis right here in the middle of town?
Why are people posting pictures of this hike they went on just to go see these like statues? Like, this is crazy. But there is a ghost called the Virgin Ghost. And pretty much if someone dies a virgin, they will like haunt and attack people, and the only way they can be appeased, or the only way that they can move on, is to like pretty much please themselves in the afterlife. So they make these monuments for them. Isn't that crazy? That is a little really odd. Yeah, there are some
crazy
things.
They have to lose their virginity in the afterlife in order to like pass on.
That's interesting. There are all sorts of crazy cryptids. So I would encourage, I mean, if you just do like a real quick Google search, Korean cryptids, I mean, that was literally how I started my search for these things. And you will just see like, I'm pretty sure there's like a whole Wikipedia page with like a whole list of them.
There is.
Yeah.
I use that Wikipedia page all the time. So
So I would encourage anyone who has 10 minutes and an interest in Korean cryptids to just go ahead and look that up and enjoy some 10 minutes of fun reading.
Very cool. All right. Well, we're going to take a little break quick. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about not so much a conspiracy theory, but I mean, it ties into conspiracy theories. So I'll leave it at that hint until we come back. So we'll be right back.
Sounds like fun.
All right, so we're back. Like I said, I'm going to talk about something conspiracy theory adjacent. So we haven't really done like a good alien conspiracy theory in a while, and we've never done like a full-fledged alien abduction story before. So I figured that it was about time to talk about one of, if not the most famous alien abduction story in recent history. So this abduction has been the basis of, or been alluded to in many movies and television episodes, including The X-Files, American Horror Story Asylum, Gravity Falls, and the Amazon Prime series Project Blue Book, which if you haven't watched that, as a listener of our show, you definitely should, because they definitely touch on a lot of conspiracy theories and cryptids that we've talked about before. So In this episode, I am talking about the famous abduction case of Barney and Betty Hill, which I keep every time that I've had to type out Barney and Betty, I wanted to type Barney and Betty Rubble, which is Fred and Wilma Flintstone's neighbors.
And best friends.
And best friends, you know, Barney and Betty Rubble. But this is Barney and Betty Hill. So Barney and Betty were a couple from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, with Barney being a postman and Betty being a social worker. They were pillars of their community and were members of the NAACP. And Barney was on the local board for the United States Commission for Civil Rights. It's also noteworthy that the Hills were an interracial couple. Barney was a black man and Betty was a white woman during the 1950s and 60s, when their marriage was not only uncommon, but often criticized as well. The Hills claimed to have been abducted by extraterrestrials sometime between September 19th and 20th of 1961, while driving through a rural portion of New Hampshire. This abduction would go on to be known as either the Zeta Reticuli incident, based on the aliens' claims to be from the Zeta Reticuli star system, or simply the Hill abduction, which is just the most clever name, you know, ever. They're the Hills, so let's just call it, they were the Hills and they got abducted, so let's just call it the Hill abduction. Super, super on the nose.
That's unfortunate. I feel like they really could have capitalized on, I mean, even their first names better than the Hill abduction.
I mean, in the, were the Flintstones around in 1961?
I want to say yes, but I don't know. I know my mom was born in 1963 and she used to watch it as a kid. So I don't know.
They've been, okay. Well, they came out in September 30th of 1960. All so right, well, they boom. Were, they had been around for about a year as of this abduction. So well,
I'm sure within that year, Barney and Betty Rubble probably did something noteworthy that they could have capitalized on.
Maybe just call it the Rubble abduction.
Yeah. Troubles for the Rubbles.
Oh, I love that. actually, I'm putting that in the episode title. Okay, so here is the entire like story of this abduction. So on the night of September 16th, 1961, around 10:30 p.m., the Hills were driving home to Portsmouth from a vacation at Niagara Falls in Montreal when Betty saw a bright point of light in the sky that moved around underneath the moon and Jupiter. They're just flying around underneath where they could see the moon. At first, Betty reasoned that it was just a shooting star until she saw it move upwards to the upper west side of the moon. You know, so obviously shooting stars, they're not going to go back up into the sky. They're usually going to go down. Betty then got the attention of her husband and convinced him to pull over at a picnic area near Twin Mountain to watch the light's erratic movement and behavior. Looking through a pair of binoculars, Betty witnessed what she thought to be a saucer-shaped craft flying around the sky. Her sister had claimed to see one similar a few years ago, so she figured this is what she was seeing as well. However, Barney initially just assumed it was a star, a satellite that had gone off course, or maybe even a commercial airliner. Betty is quoted saying, "Barney, if you think that's a satellite or a star, you're being completely ridiculous." So she was just, she was not having any of that. To which Barney agreed upon seeing it change course and turn on a dime to head straight in their direction. They quickly headed back to their car and got back on the road to home, taking a narrow mountain pass called Franconia Notch, which that's an interesting name, but okay.
This sounds dangerous.
It does. It sounds like draconian.
That should have been their first red flag. Like, hey, you know what? Let's find a different road.
I mean, their first red flag should have been the light changing course and coming directly at them. The second one should have been a narrow mountain pass named Franconia Notch or Franconia Notch. That's just like, we're going to be in trouble on this narrow mountain pass.
We're asking for it at this point.
They're almost asking for it. Like, I don't want to victim blame them, but they're being, you know, the stereotypical people in a horror movie that, you know, get killed.
Yes. Like, oh, what's that noise?
Don't go into the basement. Don't go down Franconia Notch. You know, it's plain and simple.
Yeah. One and the same.
So they continued down the road while keeping an eye on, you know, the light that was still coming after them, albeit at a distance. So it's still chasing them down this narrow mountain pass. At one point, it traveled over a restaurant and a radio tower that was alongside the road, low enough for them to see that the craft was about 40 feet or 12 meters long and was rotating as it moved. So it wasn't just flying. It was like it's spinning while it moves forward, if that makes any sense.
Yes. I think the more interesting thing is their ability to tell size at a distance.
Yeah, I can't tell size, you know, when something's standing right in front of me, you know, like I cannot look at something and go, that looks like it's about 40 feet long. I just, I do not have that ability, but in a lot of these cryptid stories and conspiracy theories and stuff, it seems like that's just a normal thing is for people to look at something and go, that looks about 6 meters tall. And it's like, how do you judge that? Cause I can't.
Like you know, like with like normal distance, like if it was like, hey, how far is it from my house to my work? Like I have no idea. Like, I measure like, distance in time. Like it's like, 20 minutes.
Like when somebody says, oh, you know that, you know, to take the left about 300 meters ahead. It's like, how far is that? Is that a block? Is that less than a block? How far? Tell me in something I can actually measure. How many bicycles is that away? You know, like what length are we talking here? Because like feet and meters really doesn't mean anything to me and I cannot judge it.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I know like – so I'm from Texas and most people I know measure distance in time. Like whether it's walking distance or driving distance. It's like, hey, how far is that? About an hour.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We do that in the Midwest as well. Because there's no landmarks, you know, it's just cornfields.
It's flat.
You know, so it's like, so it's just, you kind of judge time as distance. So anyway, so the craft continued to follow them for a while longer before suddenly descending toward them fast enough to make Barney stop the car in the middle of the highway. So he like slams on the brakes because this thing is all of a sudden like coming right at them. The craft, which Barney would later describe as looking like a huge pancake, also came to a stop, hovering about 80 to 100 feet or 24 to 30 meters above their car. Once again, arbitrary distances that I can't, I don't understand.
Yeah. They had like a rangefinder with them.
Give me a point of reference. Like, is it one telephone pole tall? Is it two telephone poles tall? Like, right. What are we talking here?
Yeah. Okay.
It was at this point that Barney did what any proper red-blooded American would. He grabbed his car pistol and put it in his pocket and got out of the car to go confront the massive hovering spacecraft.
And if there's, see that thing? I'm going to shoot it.
Well, I mean, that's the common trait in all of these stories is if it takes place in America and you don't know what it is, you go shoot at it.
Yes.
All the cryptids that we talk about, and even if it's cryptids in another country, if there's an American on the expedition, their first reaction is take your gun out.
Yep. Yeah.
That's just, that's just, a, that's our culture. When in doubt, shoot it out. But, so yeah, he grabbed his car pistol and got out of the car to go confront this 40 foot long metal spinning pancake. I don't know what your car pistol is going to do, but
ricochet.
At least, you know, at least he's brave, I guess. So he was standing there outside the car and he took out his binoculars again and peered up at the craft. Inside, he claims to have seen 8 to 11 gray humanoid figures wearing shiny black uniforms with capes. And he saw them through like a window on the craft. Like, so imagine kind of like a flat disc, you know, and it's got like a flat edge around the side. Well, that edge had windows that you could see into. And inside,
I can't stop thinking about Megamind.
Yes. I immediately think of Megamind 100%. It is just gray Megamind.
Yes.
Wearing a shiny black uniform with a cape. And they were staring back at him. So, and then all but one of the figures moved to the rear wall of the craft. And then the one that was still at the window spoke to Barney telepathically and told him Stay where you are and keep looking. And it was at this point, Barney tried to raise the pistol that he was holding in his hand, his car pistol, but he couldn't. Whether that was out of fear or, you know, mind control, I don't know. But either way, he was intending to shoot at them and could not.
Yeah, that's pretty ominous, though.
It is like, a little, yeah.
I mean, what would your reaction be if
apparently his reaction is to shoot, you know?
Well, yes, but so. This is the 60s, so.
Yeah. So after that, two red lights began rising from the craft on what looked like bat wings. So basically, like, just two little things started coming up out of the craft, and they had red lights on them. Mm-hmm. And a structure began descending from underneath while it slowly moved closer to the hill. So I'm assuming kind of like a ramp or a ladder or something like that.
Okay.
It descended down to about 50 or 80 feet or 15 to 24 meters above the ground. And it was about 300 feet or 91 meters away from Barney when he had the sudden like reactive thought that they're going to be taken.
Oh, wow.
Like just all of a sudden what came through his mind was they're going to take us. So he tore the binoculars away from his eyes and ran back to the car shouting, they're going to capture us. Like he's freaking out. Yeah. He got back in the car and raced down the highway with the craft chasing after them. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
He told Betty to keep an eye on it, so she rolled down her window to get a better look. And it was at that moment that the hills started hearing a series of rhythmic beeps and buzzing noises that sounded like they were coming from the trunk of their car. The car started vibrating, and the hills felt drowsy before falling into unconsciousness. And then upon hearing the beeps and buzzing noises a second time, they regained consciousness and found themselves 35 miles or 56 kilometers away from where they were before they passed out, and 2 hours had passed.
Wow.
Yeah. Still in their car. Like it wasn't like they'd been taken out of their car. Like their car was 35 miles down the road from where they'd been, and they'd lost 2 hours of time. And they just remember, like, feeling drowsy, and next thing they know, it's 2 hours later.
Wow.
Right.
That's super crazy.
It's kind of creepy.
That sounds like an afternoon nap as an adult.
I mean, my afternoon naps are at least 2 hours very, very consistently. Like, when I come home from work at 4:30-ish, I usually pass out until about 6:30 just because I'm, you know, dead to the world. So
yeah.
But so when the hills got home, they apparently had a strange impulse to keep their luggage by the back door of the house, maybe just to be kind of ready to leave at a moment's notice.
I can imagine.
Which I would too. Honestly, I don't really see that as a strange impulse, but every site I looked at was like, they had a strange impulse. I'm like, is it strange?
They were ready to leave.
They were ready to go. They're like, hey, if this alien craft comes to our house, let's just grab our bags and go and not unpack everything.
Yeah, I think that's a smart impulse.
That's not strange in the slightest. They also noticed that their watches no longer worked, and the leather strap on the binoculars was mysteriously torn. And also Barney's dress shoes were severely scratched and scuffed.
Interesting. Do you think maybe there was some sort of like unconscious battle? Like,
well, we'll get into that.
Oh, okay.
We'll get into what possibly happened while they were unconscious. So, after taking showers to wash away any potential contamination, they separately drew pictures of what they saw to compare notes. And their drawings were like, so basically they were like, you know, hey, I'm going to draw what I saw, you draw what you saw, and then we'll, you know, we'll see if they match up. And they did.
Yeah. Okay. So, that's a really smart way to make sure you're not just out of your mind.
Yeah. However, despite racking their brains to recall what happened, everything after the initial beeps and buzzing noises was fragmented and fuzzy. So they decided to just kind of go to bed to like clear their heads.
Yeah.
However, after only being in bed for a few hours, Betty decided to wait. She got up and decided to put the dress she had been wearing in the closet and noticed that the hem, zipper, and lining were torn beyond repair and that the dress had a strange pink powder on it that upon hanging it out on the clothesline outside, blew away in the wind. The powder just kind of blew off of it.
Interesting.
Also of note is that the trunk of the Hills car had strange circular marks on it that weren't there before, and when brought in contact with a compass, caused the needle to spin rapidly. So it was like extremely magnetized.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
10 days after the incident, Betty began experiencing strange and vivid dreams and nightmare that felt more like memories to her. She kept a journal of her dreams in great detail for 5 straight days before the dreams stopped as suddenly as they started. Barney, although he sympathized with his wife, didn't experience the dreams himself and ultimately wasn't too concerned with them. So he was just kind of like, they're just dreams, Betty. Yeah, I'm sorry that you're having nightmares, but they're just dreams.
Yeah. Which honestly, at that point, like, knowing the trauma that they potentially went through to then just like chalk it up to just dreams. Like, I think I'd be slightly more skeptical at that point.
Yeah. Not to mention, it's like anytime that you go through trauma, people deal with it differently. Some people are just like, I just don't want to talk about it. I don't want to deal with it.
Maybe that was his coping mechanism.
Yeah. Let's just let it go.
Yeah.
You know, and hers, you know, obviously came out in her dreams and her stress came out in her dreams.
Yeah.
So in one of her dreams, she recalls being surrounded by men at a roadblock while in their car. And although she fell unconscious, she eventually fought to regain consciousness. And when she did, she was being led through a forest at night by 2 small men that stood about 5'4" tall or 162 centimeters tall. Barney was close behind, but he appeared to be sleepwalking when she tried calling out to him. The men appeared somewhat human, with black hair and eyes, prominent noses, bluish lips, and grayish skin, and they wore blue uniforms with short capes attached at the shoulders. So she still remembers the capes. In fact, she said the capes reminded her of like military cadet uniforms.
Interesting.
So
maybe did they hang off like off the shoulder to the side as well, or just behind?
Maybe. I don't know. It didn't go into specifics, but okay. I mean, I'm when I think of cadet uniforms, I think of the one shoulder draping cape.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe something like that. The men led the Hills up a ramp into a disc-shaped craft before separating them and taking them into different rooms. Betty protested to the man that she identified in her journal as the leader about the separation, but he said that their examinations would take much longer if they were kept together. And so Betty complied. Yeah. A new man, who Betty referred to as the examiner, entered the room and in very broken English explained that the tests they were going to perform were just going to be simple ones in order to learn the differences between humans and the people aboard the craft. He sat her down in a chair, shone a bright light on her, cut off a lock of her hair. He also proceeded to examine her eyes, ears, mouth, teeth, throat, and hands, and also saved fingernail shavings and then used a small knife to scrape skin samples off onto like clear plastic that looked kind of like cellophane.
Okay.
The final test was a test of her nervous system and was also a sort of pregnancy test, which was conducted by forcibly jabbing like a 4-to-5-inch needle into her belly button.
Oh, nice.
Like really hard.
Yeah.
And it apparently was extremely painful and Betty cried out. But then the examiner just like waved his hand in front of her face and the pain vanished.
Interesting.
Yeah. Super creepy, kind of gross. After the examiner was finished, he left the room and Betty struck up a conversation with the leader asking where they were from. He brought up a sort of 3-dimensional kind of what she described was like we would nowadays consider like a hologram. Like they didn't really have hologram or even the concept of holograms back then. But so it was basically like a hologram map and pointed out where their planet was. Betty then noticed a book full of strange symbols and letters while she was looking around the room, and the leader told her that she could keep it as a souvenir if she'd like. However, when they exited the craft, the leader informed Betty that the other men aboard the craft had decided she couldn't keep the book because they intended to wipe their memories of what had happened that night. Wow. Betty insisted, though, that even if they did wipe her memory, she'd remember eventually. Betty's a very spunky woman.
Yeah, she sounds extremely determined.
Yes, very, very determined woman. They were escorted back to their vehicle where they were told to watch the craft take off, which they did, and then they resumed their drive. And that was the end of, like, her dreams.
Interesting.
So, yeah. A couple years later, after some publicity, because they'd kind of gone somewhat public, like they reported this abduction, or they reported their, you know, initial experience to the Air Force, actually. And then, you know, they also reported it to just like some local newspapers and stuff. So they'd had some publicity. And basically after like all of that publicity and everything, they got some recommendations to try like hypnotherapy as a way to kind of gain insight into their lost memories and maybe shed some light onto what had happened that night and maybe figure out what had happened with the lost time. So under the recommendation of Barney's psychiatrist, Mr. Stevens, they were referred to Benjamin Simon, who is a psychiatrist and neurologist from Boston who specialized in hypnotherapy. So starting January 4th, 1964, which, remember, their abduction was in 1963, so a couple years later. So starting in January 4th, 1964, and going once a week until June 6th, 1964, so for 6 months, they went once a week. Simon would hypnotize Barney and Betty in separate rooms so that they couldn't overhear each other's accounts and could keep the results as honest as possible. Okay. And then he would even go so far as to re-induce amnesia after each session so that they couldn't, like, that way they couldn't like discuss their session. Yeah. So, you know, so basically he did like everything that he could to ensure that they weren't corroborating their stories.
Yeah.
During Barney's sessions, he recounted his repressed memories from the abduction, though his memories were a bit hazy due to the fact that he claimed he'd kept his eyes closed most of that night because he was afraid. In particular, the alien's eyes terrified him, with him being quoted saying things like, "Oh, those eyes, they're there in my brain," or "I was told to close my eyes because I saw two eyes coming close to mine, and I felt like the eyes had pushed into my eyes." And also, "All I see are these eyes. I'm not even afraid that they're not connected to a body. They're just there. They're just up close to me, pressing against my eyes." So really, really did not like their eyes, apparently. And
that is terrifying.
Yes.
I mean, so the first quote that you said, "Oh, those eyes, they're there in my brain."
Yeah.
Or "they're there in my head." Like, that's, yeah,
it's creepy. So yeah. He kept his eyes closed most of the night, like only opening them occasionally. So most of his recounting is from just what he felt, not what he saw.
Yeah.
As far as his examination, because like he did recount his own examination story as well. His wasn't as detailed as Betty's, once again, because he continued to keep his eyes shut through most of it. But what he did know was that a cup of some sort was placed over his genitals to extract what he assumed was a semen sample, though he didn't experience orgasm. So he just, they just kind of like vacuumed some semen
extracted it, I guess.
Yeah. He also said that he had skin and fingernail samples taken, and that a small metal cylinder was quickly inserted and removed from his anus. And then he also noted that his vertebrae were counted. Like they individually counted his vertebrae.
Oh, okay.
Barney also noted that the alien spoke in a mumbling kind of language as well as broken English. And whenever they did speak, it was mentally via like telepathy because their mouths didn't move at all. And both Barney and Betty noted that any time that these beings talked, their mouths didn't move. So it was definitely mental. Betty's account under hypnosis was much more detailed, and although it shared a lot of commonality with her dreams, there were a few notable differences. So for the most part, her hypnotherapy was identical to her dreams. There were just a couple of differences.
Okay.
For example, the technology aboard the craft was slightly different. The appearance of the beings on board was also different. However, despite the differences from her dreams, Barney and Betty's hypnotic regression matched up almost seamlessly.
Okay.
So despite the fact that they were separated and that they reinduced amnesia afterwards, their accounts matched up like almost perfectly.
Yeah. So maybe some of those differences in the dreams were because she was like, in her subconscious had control of the dream itself. So well, maybe she was just...
The way dreams work is they kind of rationalize and compartmentalize and help us to deal with like what we've experienced throughout like our lives. So dreams will oftentimes rationalize things or unrationalize things just on your subconscious. So yeah, her dreams could have just changed them some things to make them more easy to process.
Yeah.
So she was also able to reproduce, while under hypnosis, a sketch of what she remembered the star map looked like that she was shown. So, you know, like that 3D holographic map, able to kind of like sketch it out. Her map consisted of 12 prominent stars connected by lines with three lesser lines that formed a distinctive triangle. She said she was told the stars connected by solid lines formed trade routes, whereas dashed lines were less traveled stars.
Oh, wow.
Based on this map that she sketched out, people were able to kind of figure out that these beings were from the Zeta Reticuli star system, because apparently at one point they said that they were from a world that had two suns. And Zeta Reticuli was the only one on that star map that had two suns.
So, which is so interesting.
Right? Which is why this was referred to as the Zeta Reticuli abduction.
Yeah.
As well as the Hill abduction, you know.
Yeah.
Super interesting. As far as potential explanations go, Major Paul W. Henderson from Pease Air Force Base was the man who took Betty's account on September 21st when she called and reported it to them. And he determined that the Hills had probably misidentified the planet Jupiter. However, this was later changed to optical condition, inversion, and insufficient data, which is just very, very Air Force, you know.
We
don't know. However, his report did get forwarded to Project Blue Book, which, despite being a, you know, Amazon Prime original series, Project Blue Book was a very real study of UFOs conducted by the Air Force from 1952 to 1970.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you should look it up. It's really interesting. It was a very real case study of like alien abductions and UFOs and even some cryptids and stuff like that, that ran for, you know, almost 20 years.
Wow.
So you should look at it. You should look into it. Most of it's been declassified. So, you know, it's open to the public to read, but very, very interesting stuff. And then their hypnotherapist, Benjamin Simon, concluded that it was either some perceptive or illusionary misrepresentations that occurred in relation to some real life event. So basically he thinks something did happen to them. Just from the fact that like their accounts match up even under hypnosis. But basically he thinks that whatever happened, Betty's dreams kind of were skewed to like help her process them. And by her writing them down and Barney reading them, that Barney kind of absorbed some of her ideologies, and those came out in their hypnotherapy. So he thinks something definitely happened, but maybe her dream skewed her memories and Barney reading her dream journal skewed his memories.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So now, as I've said before, this is like the first really well-documented and publicized alien abduction we know of. I'm sure there are plenty of others before this, but this was just the first one to make headline news around the world. And also, as I've mentioned many, many times over the course of this podcast, I personally believe in aliens just from a scientific and mathematically statistical standpoint. So I do personally believe that this account is possible. Whether or not it's real or not, I don't know, but I do think that it's definitely a possibility. Just the fact that their accounts, while under hypnosis and separated, lined up so much kind of adds... it just kind of adds to the reliability of their claim and their legitimacy of their claim.
Yeah.
Like hypnosis is a state of mind where you're susceptible to suggestion. So for them to recount these memories almost identically without prompting points, and without hearing each other and without like having each other's stories to go off of, points to it being some sort of real experience. You know, so just to me, it seems possible.
I think it's also interesting to note that the dreams happened after after they had drawn what they both saw.
Yeah.
So the psychiatrist saying that that you know, maybe it was kind of skewed because he read her dream journal.
Right.
That does take away. I mean, that kind of,
it doesn't take into lessons, account the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost cheapens the fact that they do have a non-corroborated, legitimate story before the dream journal.
Right. Cause the dreams didn't start happening until 10 days after the fact.
Yeah.
And they drew that picture together that night.
Yeah.
When they got home. So yeah, there, like I said, there's certain things about it that point to there being some legitimacy in it, but, but either way, it's super interesting. So that is the Zeta Reticuli abduction, or the abduction case of Barney and Betty Hill.
So I do have a question.
Sure.
Before we close this out.
Right.
Did anything that you read, mention when they spoke, when like Barney or Betty spoke back to them, did they have to speak with their mouths, or did they also speak through telepathy? Could the beings read their minds, essentially?
It didn't specifically say, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that they spoke with their mouths.
Okay.
But I mean, usually telepathy is kind of a two-way street, at least according to most lore and, you know, fiction and stuff like that. Usually telepathy is two-way. If you can project thoughts, you can read thoughts as well. But I'm just assuming that Barney and Betty just spoke the way that they normally would speak, you know. But
yeah, so yeah. the only reason I ask is because I'm a pretty big Trekkie. And so Star Trek, the first episode aired in 1966.
Okay.
Episode 13 and 14, it's a two-part story called The Menagerie.
Okay.
And it's actually based on these humanoid-esque beings that it's different because they're luring people to their planet. Mm-hmm. But they're collecting specimens of different species to keep in this menagerie, this zoo, essentially, and they're studying them, and there's they actually speak, they have telepathy,
right?
So they speak with their minds, they're able to read everyone's thoughts, they can actually project into your mind and make you believe that something's happening and stuff like that. So it's like it makes me wonder if Star Trek almost based The Menagerie off of this story.
It's very possible, at least. Like, this story or this abduction case honestly spawned a lot of what we think of when we think of modern aliens and abduction cases, you know, with them being gray, have large black eyes, big heads.
Yeah.
You know, it affected pop culture incredibly. So I would not be surprised if even Star Trek took some inspiration from it. So
yeah. It's just, that was really interesting because it was like, I'm rewatching Star Trek for like, I can't even count how many times I've watched it, but I just watched those episodes like three nights ago,
and
I
was like, it
really reminds me of that.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. Thank you for listening, and thank you, David, for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a blast.
Yeah, it was really cool having you. Once again, can you just tell people where they can find you on social media, like your YouTube channel, Instagram, or Twitter, whatever you have?
Yeah, so the best way is on YouTube, just Team Row. And then we also do have an Instagram linked to our YouTube, and vice versa. They're both on there, but that's also Team Row. So it's pretty easy to find us.
Team Row Travels or something like that. I think so. I'm pretty sure it was because I looked it up earlier, but I'm pretty sure it's Team Row Travels.
Oh, goodness. Shame on me for not even knowing.
Yeah, it's Team Row Travels. So.
Okay. All right. Well, there you have it. Sammy.
All right. Well, thank you guys once again for listening. We will be back December 15th. So we're not going to have a December 1st episode like we, we never have a December 1st episode. And we'll be back on the 15th of December with, producer Ian. So Tessa's boyfriend Ian is going to be on with us. He's never actually like really made an appearance on the show other than like you can hear him in the background a couple of times like shouting something out, but so he will kind of make his debut on our show on December 15th. So look forward to that. Check out our, you know, our social media. Pretty much everything is at CryptiPod. Check out our Patreon, stuff like that. I don't know what else. I think that's everything. So with that being said, don't forget, Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiriesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptipod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.